The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Brought to you by Standard Life. Retirement specialists getting you ready for your second life.
Now, I'm joined in studio by Jack Corgan-Jones, political correspondent with the Irish Times, and Brenda Power, columnist with the Sunday Times and the Irish Daily Mail. Happy New Year, both.
Happy New Year, Tom.
Thanks so many for coming in. And we're going to be running through your papers. Quite a few in it. If we look quickly at the front pages, the Irish Times saying lead story is pursued tanker on course for Irish waters. This is the story that the US Coast Guard began pursuing a vessel 2 weeks ago as it sailed to Venezuela. And it is now heading for Irish waters. We're going to be talking about that in a bit more detail. After 10 o'clock, front page of the Irish Independent, speeding drivers face extra penalty points in new laws, resurrected new laws. I think Shane Moss wanted to do that a few years ago. The Irish Examiner, short-term lets mostly empty is the story. Occupancy rates can drop to as low as 4% across the country as we're looking at the new homeless figures, I suppose, which are particularly bad. And then to the Irish Daily Mail, and a really interesting front page, and this is where we're going to start with our panel. Show your ID to get online. Anyone wanting to access their social media will have to download a state-run app under radical plans to safeguard children online. Jack, what's the detail of this one?
Well, I mean, it's part of this whole kind of online safety crusade that Patrick O'Donovan, the communications minister, has made central to his recent communications to the press. And you know, I think that the kind of political instinct underlying it is a good one. I think that he has probably accurately assessed that parents up and down the country have a fairly severe degree of concern over what their kids are accessing online. And I think there's another story elsewhere in the papers today in the Examiner about TikTok and the kind of things that people are getting served up with people between the ages of 13 and 15, which is very concerning altogether. So the exact kind of technical modalities of how this is going to work is a little bit beyond me, to be honest. But the way I kind of conceive of it is, you know, when you log into My Welfare or My Revenue and you use your MyGov ID. So anyone who has accessed a kind of online social welfare payment or gone to pay their local property tax or have an interaction with revenue through those online kind of portals, I think it's going to work a little bit like that. So you have a kind of infrastructure that sits on top of the social media site and you go and you click and uses your government validated MyGov ID to confirm you are who you say you are and your age. And thereafter, at least in theory, you sail on through the website if you're old enough, or it boots you back if you're not old enough. Now, look, this is kind of early stage on this. We shouldn't be led into believing this is going to be something that we wake up today, tomorrow, or next week and have to deal with. It is a pilot program that's going to take place in the early part of this year, I think. But the legislation actually underpinning a wider rollout of this hasn't been brought forward yet. We don't know exactly what that's going to look like or exactly what the timeline for its introduction. And as we know, you know, often the timelines for the full scale introduction of these things can be a little bit elastic. But this is the direction of travel, some sort of infrastructure that makes it a little bit harder to have unfettered access to social media sites for kids.
Brent, I have to say, when I saw this morning, my first thought was, God, this is very 1984. And then my second thought was when you read through the detail of maybe this is the most efficient way of achieving the goals that Jack is talking about. Where do you come down?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the concern is that the very people you are trying to protect with this law are the ones who are most likely to find a way to circumvent it. The younger generation, the likes of us will you know, follow whatever digital wallet proceedings we have to. But that's the only concern I would have. I completely sympathise with the minister's objective, and he keeps using the analogy of you wouldn't, if you were a kid was sitting at a bar, you wouldn't serve them a drink. And we do have reservations about, you know, giving children access to dangerous substances. And here is potentially the most caustic, the most dangerous substance of all, the access, unfettered access to porn, to grooming, to gambling, to, you know, God knows what. And we have no break on it. So, I mean, I think there will be, as Jack said, a lot of parental support for this. It's just the logistics of it. I saw one of the queries that was put to the minister in the Mail piece was, you know, there'll be some concern that you're going to use this to track our, you know, as you say, 1984 type supervision or surveillance. And he said, oh, sure, I have better things to be doing with my time. No one thinks he's going to do it personally. Yeah. You know, we don't expect the minister is going to be going through our social media feeds. But of course, it does open up that possibility.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it does potentially bring the minister or the state into conflict with data protection activists. And I was mentioning the kind of my welfare and the public services card. That rollout was immensely controversial a few years ago. Do you remember they really got into trouble with the data protection commissioner? So that's one layer of implementation that might be tricky. So, you know, the politics of it makes sense. The policy is going to be tricky, getting it actually into place. And then the other as well is going to be potentially butting heads with the social media giants themselves. I mean, they will often pay lip service to the idea that they are in favour of greater online protections for vulnerable users or for younger people. Okay. But, you know, any time regulation or regulatory intent creeps up on the kind of the license, the print money that they have, you know, the algorithms, or any time regulators suggest maybe increasing responsibility for the directors of these companies in the jurisdictions that they operate in, both of which are ideas that they've been quite hostile to, the pushback will come on. So, look, it's a good, in every sense, I think it's a good kind of intent underlying it. I think his political instincts are good on this. But actually landing it is much more difficult.
The encouraging thing is we're not the only country trying to do this. And Australia has already introduced a social media ban on under 16s. And the whole world, I think, is watching to see how that works out. So, I mean, there's no question there's a momentum building behind this kind of measure. So hopefully, I mean, I think most parents would agree something has to be done to limit.
And the UK has quite successfully brought in limits and gotten companies to stick with them as well. So it'd be interesting to see whether we can follow there. That's the front page of your Mail. One of the stories that Brent has been making the papers in a variety of guises, but the headline figure is 17,000 homeless people in the country, up almost 12% on last year.
I know. It really does seem to be heading in one direction all the time. It is, I mean, honestly, Sean, you don't know what to say about it anymore. The reality is this is 17,000 people who don't have a home of their own. I mean, I know they're not all without shelter, but, you know, when you think of the comfort you get yourself from going home, lighting a fire, sitting by the sofa, sitting on the sofa, just watching your own television. The fact that there are 17,000 people who cannot access that minimal comfort at this time of year is really shocking, and I don't see any short term solution to it, I'm afraid.
And we've been talking about, I mean, this has been a new barrier, Jack, politically. I remember when 10,000 was the figure that they didn't want to breach, and that's been left in the dust. But Simon Harris is in a bit of trouble when it comes to talking about who is actually on this list. And I think the figures are interesting, and they're in your own paper, that when you look at who is on the homeless list, vast majority, obviously, in Dublin when it comes to both children and adults, but also nationality-wise, half were Irish, 30% were from outside the European Economic Area, and 20% from in the EEA / the UK. What has Simon Harris been suggesting? Is he saying that basically there's people in emergency accommodation who shouldn't be entitled to it?
So what he said in an interview in our own paper with my colleague Ellen Coyne before Christmas, was that there were significant numbers of migrants in emergency accommodation who don't have a housing right. Now, that has been challenged by a lot of advocacy groups and charities working in the sector who say that, you know, it's actually having a technical right to housing is not an issue. But I think what's not in dispute is the kind of compositional nature of the population in emergency services and where they come from. And I think that the government has been trying to kind of draw attention to this as part of its hardening up stance on migration in recent weeks and months. Particularly Minister for Justice Jim O'Callaghan, who has spoken about the impact of rising population and the associated input of immigration on that and the impact that has on services. And I think that that's the point that they're getting at. And when you look at, you know, the nationality figures, I suppose, as you say, in emergency accommodation, it is probably higher than people would have realised. People from outside the European Economic Area, say 30% from outside the EEA. But the point that the advocacy groups are saying is that those people do have a right to access housing supports in almost all instances. And that's why they're calling on the Taoiseach to withdraw or clarify
his remarks.
So there
are people who are here with a work permit or have been granted asylum, as opposed to people who are...
Yeah. Now, as is always the case, when you drill down into any policy area, but particularly when it comes to migration and housing, there's complexities and shades of grey. So, for example, like a segment that, in my understanding, is growing at the moment is people who are leaving direct provision and then accessing homelessness services. And the reason that they're leaving direct provision is because they've acquired a status. They have a refugee status here. They have a right to live and work, but they've often overstayed in direct provision after they get that status, even though they're not entitled to a bed in direct provision anymore. But the pressure is coming on them to leave because the direct provision system has to be used to accommodate people who are arriving into the system and their need and their refugee status is being assessed. But they have nowhere to go. You know, they are then being asked to go into the private rental accommodation sector, which is obviously chock-a-block and very expensive. So a growing number of the people in emergency accommodation are coming from direct provision. So look, there's a lot of different kind of compositional factors at work, but like there's also a lot of political pressure on these overlapping, intersecting issues of housing, homelessness, and now migration announcing itself as well.
Yeah, because during the week, in response to Simon Harris's comments, I think it was the Dublin Homeless Services Authority said that the biggest single driver of single-person homelessness in the country is people leaving direct provision, who've either got permission to remain or refugee status. But, I mean, it's interesting, you know, that he talked about a right to housing, because constitutionally nobody has a right to housing. Yeah. I mean, there is no such thing as a constitutional right to housing. I mean, the local authorities have an obligation to accommodate people who are without somewhere to live. But there's no such thing as a right in anybody to housing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how you differentiate between people who have sort of an implied right or, you know, an inherited right or a citizen residential related right, I don't know how you're going to do that.
Yeah, it's a bit of a minefield. People texting in on this as well, 087-1400-106 is your WhatsApp. Sean, the homeless figures don't include couch surfers, people in refuge, young adults living with their parents. Mm. The metric that is included in Finland's homeless figures, if we don't know what the real figure is, we can't possibly hope to tackle the problem efficiently or effectively. A lot of sense in that text. And of course, the real scale of homelessness isn't picked up in the official figures as bad as they are. Jack, we're going to go to the front page of the Indo for the next story. And this is sort of a revival of what was a former government's promise to increase, to have graduated, I suppose, penalty points for speeding in response to the awful year we saw in 2025.
Yeah, as you said in the tee-up, this is something that I originally associated with Shane Ross when he was Minister for Transport, and part of his whole political brand was this kind of crusading action against dangerous driving on the roads. And it's something that he was a fan of, and then it kind of went into abeyance under Eamon Ryan, and now Sean Canney, who's the super junior attending cabinet for the independent ministers, he seems to be looking to reanimate it. It is something the guards have looked for as well previously. Drew Harris wants this, and presumably it's because they think it'll be an effective way of actually punishing in a way that is commensurate with the offence. So, you know, we all know that the speeding penalty is three penalty points, but if you kind of go further over, so for example, if you're at 85 kilometres per hour in an 80 kilometre hour zone, you get your 3 points. But if you go up to 160, let's say, in 120 zone, and you do see people doing this, you know, you're often steaming down the motorway yourself doing 120 and someone flies past you in the other lane. So if you're doing that kind of thing, you can get up to 7 points. So basically, a harsher punishment for people who break the law in a more egregious way. The issue, I suppose, is going to be, you know, how has Sean Canney or anyone else in the Department of Transport thought of a solution to the problems that led Eamon Ryan to abandon it last time, which was seemingly just too difficult to put in place. And we all know that when speeding offences get caught up in the courts, there's many myriad ways of challenging them. And presumably, if you introduce more complexity and more conditionality into the type of offence you're prosecuting, there are more ways to challenge it and potentially overcome it in the courts as well. I would presume that's one of the reasons that they held back.
I think we saw there was a national slowdown day that one driver was caught doing something like three times the speed limit in one particular area. I mean, I honestly don't think people are as terrified of penalty points as this law presumes. And there was that report a couple of weeks ago about the use of the poor box to allow drivers to escape the last 2 points that would push them over the limit and remove their licenses. Mm. And judges were facilitating this. And there was a suggestion that provision for judges to apply the poor box to speeding offences was going to be removed. I don't know if it has or not. But there does seem to be a degree of judicial lenience towards driving offences. I mean, I've long argued that if you lose your driving license for a serious speeding offence for more than 6 months, you should have to resit your driving test. Mm. I cannot think of anything that would terrify me more than the prospect of having. I genuinely mean it. Yeah. And I mean, you
that
know.
That and the leaving cert.
That and the leaving
right
cert
there,
are the yeah. two things that you have nightmares about. But genuinely, I think if your driving is bad enough that you have to be taken off the road for a year, you really should relearn to drive. Mm. That would put manners on people.
That's a great idea.
It's a brilliant idea.
It is, yeah, and that would certainly terrify people. I think the problem with people not being afraid of penalty points, it doesn't matter what they are if there's no one there to enforce them.
This
I didn't see a single guard out around Christmas. I don't know about you guys.
People react to the likelihood, I think, of getting caught, not necessarily this spectre of more serious punishment if they do get caught. Mm. If people assess in their day-to-day motoring activities, there's a higher likelihood of either coming across a traffic guard or being detected by an average speed camera. Or one interesting line in Sean Canny's op-ed in the Indo is talking about detecting dangerous driving activities like using your phone, using cameras.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if people assess there's a higher likelihood of being caught by a camera when you're distracted driving, i.e. sitting there, one eye on the road, one eye on your phone, I think there is a higher likelihood that they will stop that activity. You know, the sense that they can use kind of scare tactics, you know, if you do get caught, you're going to be punished ever more severely. Instead of an effective apparatus of detection, I think is kind
but
of.
But I mean, you know, you hear a lot about, oh, we should do this and we should increase detection and we should increase deterrence. Basically, it does come down to personal responsibility. And I do think a lot of this argument sort of absolves people of the responsibility, which is on every driver. And I did hear one of the authorities who's involved explaining why there's such congestion on the M50, saying most of the collisions are down to motorists looking at their phones.
Mm. Yeah.
Most of them are rear-ending because of inattention. And you see it all the time. Anytime I have passed a collision on the M50, it's two drivers standing there by their cars because one of them was looking at the phone. And I mean, I do think, you know, all of this talk about we need to, you know, amend accident black spots and some roads need better attention. Basically, you are talking about people not taking care. And I think the rudeness and the bad behaviour on the road has increased. Even driving in, a guy cut across in front of us without indicating. I mean, rudeness, impatience, inattention. It's personal responsibility.
Completely. And the amount of people I've seen recently who are openly scrolling on TikTok, who have the phone up in that little holder near the thing and are just scrolling through and listening to it or watching it as they're going is kind of remarkable.
Make them resit their driving
and discover that TikTok is not actually on the curriculum for it. My thanks to both of you for coming in and a happy new year to you, Jack Horgan-Jones, the Irish Times, Brenda Power as well. Thank you so much for coming in and for talking through the various stories in the papers.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Brought to you by Standard Life. Retirement specialists getting you ready for your second life.